Hello and welcome to Press TV News Analysis. I'm Kavit Afwai. In this news analysis, we will examine how U.S. democracy is on the decline. One example, the systemic use of violence by the police, in which earlier this year, three Afghan Americans fell victim to the excessive use of force by the police, with a fourth brain dead from a police taser. Even former U.S. Vice President Al Gore has said U.S. democracy has been hacked, blaming corporate interests for the damage. Gore said it is time for an occupied democracy movement to fix America's political system.
Pallbearers carrying the coffin of an American teenager shot to death by the U.S. police in the Harlem neighborhood of New York City. Ramerly Graham was hit in February inside his father's home. Police first claimed he was armed, but later it turned out that Graham was unarmed when he was killed.
Nothing. And I can't get no answers. Why this happened? Why is that happened to me? Why?
Bromberly is not the only victim of recent police brutality. In California, police have killed a decorated Marine in front of his children. Police say Sergeant Manuel Loggins Jr. was a threat to his children. But friends and colleagues of the former soldier have described him as anything but violent. Another young man was severely wounded in Oakland. 24-year-old Tony Jones was shot in the back by police as he tried to run away from them. He was also unarmed. Again in February, footage emerged of an unarmed, handcuffed girl being tased by Florida police. 20-year-old Danielle Maudsley is still in a coma. The officer who tasered her has been cleared of any wrongdoing. The U.S. issues annual reports about human rights violations in other countries. Such reports usually target those nations whom the U.S. government considers as adversary. Amnesty International has slammed Washington over the matter, condemning it for, quote, criticizing other countries' behavior while failing to uphold proper standards itself.
Well, let's discuss democracy in the U.S. along with their human rights track record. Let me introduce our guests. We have human rights and international lawyer Paul Wolf, who joins us from Washington. And from the International Action Center, Taleb Maupin joins us from New York. Gentlemen, thank you both. Let me start with you, Taleb Maupin. For the first time ever, the U.S. came under question at the Human Rights Council in Geneva last year. Discrimination against Muslims and police brutality were cited as two of the top main concerns. Why this decline overall, and then especially in these two areas, do you think?
Well, there's a number of factors involved with this situation. One of which is that the United States is ruled by a small elite who have the money and the wealth and the power in the U.S., less than 1% most likely, but they're commonly called the 1% among the Occupy Wall Street movement. And they're seeing their power threatened as the people are pouring into the streets and demanding justice. And so as a result, they've been forced to reveal themselves in a way and reveal the brutality that they wage. The second reason is the hypocrisy involved. The U.S. goes around the world invading people's countries, burning people's holy books, shooting people, murdering people, overthrowing governments, all in the name of defending human rights. But if you want to see the human rights the U.S. is talking about, you can look in Libya, where NATO bombs have destroyed the country and people are now in misery. You can look in Afghanistan, where the people are suffering under horrific occupation and oppression. And you can also look in New York City, where the police murder people and get away with it, where demonstrators are clubbed and pepper sprayed when they try to exercise their free speech. And you can look in the U.S., which has one of the highest prison populations on the planet. This whole notion that the 1% controlled government in the U.S., which is a tool of the bankers and the corporations, is an entity that has the right to speak about human rights and defend it internationally is false. The U.S. is one of the greatest violators of human rights in the world, and it should be regarded as such. And I think it's a great thing that many people are realizing this and the people are standing up to this 1% controlled government and not letting it say it represents human rights when in reality it represents the repression and the further enslavement of human beings.
Paul Wolf, same question to you. And keep in mind, of course, we can refer to some examples, the deaths at the hands of U.S. police this year. One was taser-related as a result, brain dead. And then the three African Americans, including a former U.S. Marine. I mean, why has police brutality increased so much?
I think some of it may be cultural. I think there are exaggerated fears among the American people right now, and it's been going on for 10 years, fears of terrorism, which is American people associate that with the Muslim community, is unfair and racist as that is a reality. And I think that when we see the police reacting like this and shooting people, they're essentially reacting out of fear. So the policies are certainly not determined by the police, but there are a lot of things that we could do to keep the police under control. You know, the UK, the police don't even have guns. So I think that the tendency to go in with guns drawn and expect a shootout, a lot of innocent people, not just recently, but over the last, let's say, 20, 30 years, a lot of them related to drug arrests have been shot simply because the police broke down the wrong door. So I think there are some institutional things that could be done with particularly local police departments to try to bring them back to reality and not imagine these horrible violent situations that don't really occur as often as you would think from their reactions. But the main problem really is Americans' fears, and I think those are really social issues, and the United States is going to keep fighting this war on terrorism and imagining that we have terrorists hiding in every crowd. I think that's part of what we see with Occupy Wall Street. I think that the unprecedented public displays of anger at the government are really scaring a lot of people. We haven't seen anything like this really since the 1960s and early 1970s. So that is essentially driving the policies, are the fears of the public. And when you see politicians, they may sound crazy, people like Rick Santorum or Newt Gingrich or whoever you want to name, they may sound crazy, but you remember that these guys are professional politicians and they wouldn't be saying those things if they weren't popular with the American people. So I think we really have a kind of a social misunderstanding of the Middle East, and we have to do what we can to not try to overthrow those governments and replace them with governments that look like America. That's kind of a ludicrous idea, but what we need to do is accept other cultures, other beliefs, and not look at them, first of all, as enemies of the United States.
Well, let me bring in Saul Landau from Berkeley. He's vice chair of the Institute for Policy Studies to have him join in on the conversation. Saul Landau, our two guests have mentioned the U.S. conduct in other countries, well, not the conduct, in the wars that they're involved in. And I'd like to ask you, is the way that U.S. soldiers have conducted themselves, we can refer to Afghanistan just recently, even though media are reporting one lone U.S. soldier being involved, but there are up to 20 who were involved in the killing of 16 civilians. Other cases have been reported, along with just the misconduct, generally speaking, of the way U.S. soldiers have carried themselves in these wars. Does it mirror the way now that the police inside the U.S. perhaps are dealing with plain old ordinary Americans?
I don't think really a lot has changed. I think soldiers have always behaved this way in war, and they will behave this way in war. Especially when they don't see any end to the war. They don't see any reason for their being there. The massacres occurred in the Korean War. There were massacres, the famous My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where a couple of hundred people were just slaughtered in a village. One officer said, well, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. I mean, these were the kinds of things that happened.
Let me bring an example. 168 taser-related deaths occurred mostly at the hands of U.S. police between 2009 and 2012. That's over 500, based on last count, since the year 2001. There's got to be something wrong with U.S. electrocuting Americans on a weekly basis.
Well, do you remember the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, where the United States annihilated 80-something people who really were not a threat to anybody? They blew them up and burned them to death. There was a case in Philadelphia where a group of black Muslims were in a house and they bombed the house. This behavior is not new. The technology now, the taser guns, these gas grenades and so on, these are new. Recently here where I live in Oakland, California, the police not only arrested 400 people from the Occupy movement, but they fired tear gas grenades right into the face of several of the people. In fact, badly injuring one Iraqi war veteran. So I think police violence is old as the hills in this country, and the technology, in a sense, has allowed them to make it more lethal. I mean, I think that's what's new about it, not the violence, but that the technology really allows now the police to do things that they couldn't have done before. Now the use of drones to spy on people, and especially to spy on Muslims, as the New York police were doing over the last couple of years. The idea that this country holds dear its civil liberties, I mean, if you listen to the official rhetoric, this is ridiculous. This country has had mass arrests during the Occupy movement, and the police have behaved very brutally, including with young women. They have thrown them to the ground and forced them into very difficult positions and beaten them. And so any notion that the United States police and officials relate to civil liberties is fiction.
Okay, Caleb Maupin, switching gears a little bit, it was interesting the way that the U.S. democracy was described by former VP Al Gore, that it had been, quote, hacked. What do you think he means by that?
Well, I don't know what Al Gore means by democracy, because when Al Gore was in office, he was just another continuer of the policies we're seeing now. He carried out imperialistic intervention in Serbia and elsewhere. But I will say this, you know, one of the most striking things about this massacre that went on in Afghanistan is this is the future that the U.S. has to offer the next generation. It doesn't have jobs for the next generation of youth. It doesn't have education. Education's being cut. But the military recruitment is there, and they do have the opportunity for young people to be sent to other countries abroad, to be put into situations and to be trained to be murderers and to be killers, like this has happened. I mean, this is a continual policy of repressing people, and the only option left for young people is to not be educated, to not have a future, but instead to join the ranks of an army being sent around the world to make sure other people don't rise up against the same conditions that are being faced by working people across the U.S. It is very frustrating and very shocking. And the fact that young people, you know, it's so crazy that all our lives in the U.S. we're taught the U.S. is a great country because there's democracy and there's freedom and people are allowed to express themselves. But a generation right now tried to actually use that freedom, and they poured into the streets, and they're seeing what this freedom actually means if you ever try to use it. The 1% government that runs the U.S. has never been a democracy. It has always been a dictatorship by the super rich who control the banks, the factories, the media, the school system, and they've utilized all of the wealth of this world in order to make more and more money for themselves. And now people are revolting. And what Occupy Wall Street, you know, what we're starting to understand is that the people in Afghanistan fighting against the United States and fighting to liberate their country, the people in Libya fighting against the NATO occupiers, they're our allies. They're our allies in a global class war against these bankers and these corporations. And we need the working class in the U.S., not just the radical youth, but all of the working class in the U.S., the people who are being laid off, the people who are having their homes foreclosed. We all need to join in a global struggle against these bankers and these corporations. Because ultimately, the bankers and the 1% that Occupy Wall Street is fighting against are not just the enemies of people here in the U.S., they're the enemies of people all over the world. It is the U.S. and the corporations that are causing poverty throughout the world, and it is the U.S. and the bankers and the corporations that are threatening wars that created and backed the State of Israel, and which is repressing and brutalizing the Palestinian people. And ultimately, if we want to see change, there needs to be a global alliance between workers and oppressed people in every corner of the globe, standing up to this 1%, engaging in heroic actions like Occupy Wall Street is engaged in, where we take over buildings, we refuse to let system continue as usual, we confront the police, we confront the state, and we ultimately call out and we say, we are the 99%, not just the 99% in the U.S., but the 99% of humanity against a small ruling elite who does nothing but owns, while the rest of us produce all of the wealth of this world.
Well, Paul Wolf, let's look at the human rights outside of the United States. We touched on a couple of them, but as a human rights and international lawyer, perhaps you can shed light on this thing called the Leahy Law, which is a law prohibiting U.S. military assistance to foreign military units that violate human rights. I mean, the U.S. is militarily assisting many countries in the Persian Gulf, like Bahrain. There's contracts set to be through the year 2015 in the billions of dollars. And, of course, these regimes are oppressing the people. So what does that show? Why isn't this case being taken up legally in the U.S.? Why does the U.S. keep providing military assistance in the form of weapons, etc., to these Persian Gulf countries?
Well, obviously, someone has made the decision that this is in the best interest of U.S. foreign policy. You know, the people who work in this field are Machiavellian. They call it the school of realism. Essentially, anything goes, and there are no rules in international relations. That's the type of thinking that you're dealing with here. So, you know, I wouldn't really be too surprised about that. In terms of human rights and human rights advocacy, my feeling has always been, and I could quote Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, that human rights begins at home. So as human rights activists, and I think all of the people you have on the show today really would qualify, our job is really to clean our own house first. It's not to point our finger at Syria or Libya and saying, look at what these other people are doing wrong. We have to go in there and do something about it. There's no doubt that there are horrible things and people being massacred all over the world all the time. But our job really is to clean up our own house first and to make sure that we're not violating human rights. And whether that's tasering 160 people that didn't need to be restrained with sometimes lethal force, or whether it's criticizing out-of-control soldiers. And I think that what you see in Afghanistan is really the tip of the iceberg. And I think that there are all kinds of war crimes happening all the time that the media never finds out about. So I think it's a really good thing for people to do, to criticize their own government. That is human rights advocacy, and that is not being disloyal in any way to their government. So, you know, I think that this kind of pressure is good. I would like to see this incident in Afghanistan used as maybe a blessing in disguise, as a way to generate the political will to leave Afghanistan, and for President Obama to say, look, we finally recognize that our presence is not helping, and we'll leave, and if you need us, give us a call. But right now what we're doing is causing extreme problems in your country. So that's what I think the result of these incidents should be, and it's entirely legitimate for human rights activists to criticize their own governments.
And they're advocating democracy in Afghanistan. Sal Landa, democracy needs to be a government, based on my last reading, by the majority of the people. Al Gore says that democracy has been hacked in the U.S. What is the case in the U.S.? How long do you think this democracy, to use his word, has been hacked? And to use the Occupy Movement phrases, is the 1%, as our guest in New York has said, ruling the 99% more than ever before?
Well, I think you have to start the answer with the response to the 9/11 attacks, which were clearly atrocities. They were horrible. But the response has been essentially to remove civil liberties. Instead of increased civil liberties, instead of trusting the citizens to do vigilance and talk to each other and begin to think about how security ought to be done, the government essentially said, we'll take care of all of it. And they passed this Patriot Act and Homeland Security and set up all of these systems that now deprive Americans of their own civil liberties and their rights. For example, the president now can order the execution of an American citizen without any due process of law. They can have the detention of a U.S. citizen without even going back to the rights of the Magna Carta. Forget our own Constitution. Now, these are infringements on liberties that did not exist before 9/11. That, in other words, the situation has become worse. The police now using drones to spy, the hacking in, if you like, to the social networking and to people's emails. This is going on a scale that is unprecedented. And it's all under the aegis of the Patriot Act, of Homeland Security, of protecting the country against terrorism. This is really nonsense. If we look at the cases that the FBI has made, most of the cases of alleged terrorist plots have been plots that have been planned by FBI provocateurs, that is, paid agents of the FBI who go into a community and offer people money if they will participate in some terrorist act. And the people who are poor usually take the money, not even knowing what the plot is about. So that the plots themselves have been fabricated. This is a bad situation. And in the sense of democracy, well, if we don't have real democracy at home, you know, this is the only country, by the way, that has its elections on a work day. Almost the rest of the world all votes on days off, where it's easier to vote. This is a country where it's really hard for people to vote. 2.5 million people have been removed from the polls by Republicans, where crazy identification laws are now coming in state after state that make it really difficult, if not impossible, for mainly poor people and minorities to vote. And yet, this is the product that we want to export abroad. Well, the president claimed we have successfully exported it to Iraq, where only 13,000 people died in bombings last year, and where recently 16 people were stoned to death because they were emo worshipers. That is, they had bought into an American cultural phenomenon with spiked hairdos and particular kinds of T-shirts and tight-fitting jeans, and where gays are being prosecuted or persecuted in Baghdad. So what we're exporting is very expensive, it's very costly, and the product doesn't travel well. I'd leave it at that.
Okay, well, let me bring in Kelly Maupin. Kelly Maupin, our guest there, Sal Landau, talked about the Patriot Act. Of course, you're familiar with the NDAA bill. He also talked about that, authorizing arrests without just cause. And then you have this Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act, which restricts gatherings and protests at special public places. What are we looking at here? I mean, these are examples of violations of the First Amendment. What happened to the First Amendment? What's happening with the Constitution?
Well, it's interesting that all of the things you described are being used to allegedly protect people from terror. But let's think about who the U.S. has considered to be terrorists in the past. Nelson Mandela, when he waged a struggle against the apartheid government in South Africa, was called a terrorist by the U.S. government. The Provisional Irish Republican Army, as they fought to free their country from British imperialism, was also called terrorists. The Maoist rebels in Nepal, as they fought to bring down an absolute monarchy, were also called terrorists by the U.S. government and still are. So if you look at it, overall, the U.S. government is not anyone who should be protecting us from terrorism. In fact, the U.S. is engaging in terrorism all over the world right now, whether it's Israel, whether it's in Africa, whether it's anywhere. The U.S. is engaging in terrorism. So the idea that they would protect us from terror is very scary. They're not trying to protect the people from terror. They're trying to protect their system from the wrath of the people as they boil in anger at its results, which are largely economic at this point. People are suffering in mass economically. And I don't think there's any popular support for these policies. I think the popular support is only amongst the halls of power, where they're bracing. This idea that you can't protest in any quote-unquote official building, what is that? What is an official building? The law is so vaguely defined. I mean, it would just make a federal offense out of things that are exercising free speech. The National Defense Authorization Act says they can detain anybody, anyone, on suspicion of being a terrorist. They don't even have to prove it. All kinds of legislation is being used to make sure that the government has the ability to do anything it can to keep itself in power amidst the rage of the people. And if all the polls that are coming out right now show people are extremely dissatisfied with this system and extremely dissatisfied with the fact that there is a 1% with all the wealth in its power, all the wealth in its hands, and all the power and all the resources, while the people have nothing. And ultimately, you know, the polls are also showing that people are coming to an understanding that the word socialism, which has been presented as the opposite of capitalism and has been demonized in the U.S. for a long time, is not such a bad word, and that the idea that we could hold in common all of these resources which we have produced, yet the 1% owns, you know, that's not such a bad thing. And many people are turning away from capitalism and turning against the capitalist system in the U.S. and looking for a more compassionate and more human need-based and a more truly democratic alternative. And I'm sure that really scares the ruling elite, and especially scares the ruling elite that this Occupy Wall Street movement is not aligning with them and not saying we want to make their system better and we just want to help them do better in their pursuit of oppressing and repressing the people of the world. But it's aligning with the people of the world in their struggle for justice. And
that is
a beautiful
thing.
All right,
we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Kelly Maupin there from New York International Action Center. We had Paul Wolf from Washington, who's a human rights and international lawyer. And from Berkeley, Sal Landau, vice chair of the Institute for Policy Studies. Thank you, the viewer, for watching another edition of the Press TV News Analysis. Any questions or comments, newsroom@presstv.ir. From Mika Vitafoy and the entire team, it's goodbye.